You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Janine DeGiovanni has been covering conflicts around the world for decades. Bosnia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Sierra Leone, Chechnya, Kosovo, and now the war in Syria. She's the author of a number of books, the most recent being Ghost by Daylight, and she's written for The Daily Beast, Newsweek, Granta, and The New York Times. Her most recent article for Vanity Fair, where she's a contributing editor, is Syria's Unspoken Crimes, about how rape has become a commonplace in the conflict there. She joins us now to talk about the situation in Syria and the challenges of reporting in that country. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
You were in Syria last summer when the conflict there turned into a real civil war. What was that time like, and what was the transition? I was wondering if the transition to war was obvious.
I think I began to see a real shift in Damascus initially when I was reporting there, from a place that seemed very much in a bubble, that war was happening somewhere else, not in their city. I haven't been back to Damascus since October, but I have been back to other parts of Syria as recently as 5 weeks ago. Now it is very much a very brutal civil war with nearly 100,000 people killed, 1.4 million refugees. But it is becoming nearly impossible for us to report. It's just getting harder and harder.
Why is that?
Well, the reason is that right now there's more kidnapping than there has ever been. Foreign journalists are targets, and it's usually the ones that go in without. There's two ways to work in Syria. One is you go in with government permission, and then you travel in via Lebanon. And this means you have an official visa, and you work usually. I was able to work pretty freely, and I could write what I wanted to write, but it got increasingly difficult, and getting visas is very hit or miss. You don't know if you will get one or why you get one or why you don't get one, and the sad truth is that I'd say 98% of journalists who want one don't get them. So the other option is that many freelancers are going to Turkey and crossing over, or other parts. Initially, when they were working with rebel groups, they were welcomed, of course, because they were taking great risks, and they were coming to tell the story of those who were fighting against Assad. But with the rise of more and more fundamentalist groups, and with the kind of economic breakdown of Syria, there's been this horrific rise of abduction. And it's something that we've seen this before. We've seen it in Iraq, and we've seen it in Chechnya, of course, and the Philippines, and going back to the civil war in Beirut. But now what's really frightening, and what's emerged over the past few days with more disappearances of my colleagues, is that there seems to be sometimes no declared motive. Well, you can see if there is economic reason that they're kidnapping a journalist to get money from a government or from their news organization. There's recently been a few that almost seem to have absolutely no motive, just to take Western reporters or NGO workers or doctors or people that before would have been welcomed by the insurgents.
And some of them are pretty prominent, like Richard Engel, the reporter for NBC, who was kidnapped.
Do you think it's to
get some attention?
I think it could be. I think it could be that. I think it could also be, in some cases, though, it's not, because often, in the case of Engel, he's very famous and he works for a network, but a lot of the people that are missing, and I think at the moment it's 15 who have gone missing, they're not famous. They're freelancers. They don't actually work for, some of them don't even work for organizations, so they kind of just disappear, and strangely enough, the people who take them don't really seem to be taking them for any specific reason that they want people to know about them. This is what's really becoming frightening, and it's a real issue for myself and other reporters that know that we need to cover this war. I mean, this is a war that desperately needs to be reported and reported properly. But on one hand, very experienced journalists don't want to go because they see how dangerous it is. And usually experience comes with years, and that means you're older. And by that point, most people have families, and they don't want to risk it. So it's left to the younger reporters who are starting out and you know, are more gung-ho. But that means that they, first of all, don't have the instincts which come from years and years and years of working in armed conflicts. But also they don't have the backing. You know, the most important person to me on the ground is always my fixer. I rely so heavily, and a fixer is someone I pay, or a reporter pays, who's a local, usually a local journalist or a student or a, it could be a housewife. I've worked with housewives. I've worked with just people that I've met at demonstrations. But it's someone that you need to connect with and trust on a very deep level. And the thing is that now the prices for these fixers has also risen to an absolutely skyrocketed rate. And a freelancer can't afford $200, $250 a day. So they're getting into cars that they maybe shouldn't get into. At the border, for instance, jumping into a car full of soldiers to get a free ride into Aleppo, or jumping into a car, sharing it with people they don't know. I mean, all the things that you need to do to be cautious is very difficult if you're 23 or 24 or 25 and you're just starting out and you want to cover a war, and maybe an editor says to you, you know, go, and if you get some good copy, I'll publish it. I mean, that's quite enticing to a young reporter. And I'm very, very concerned about it right now, because I feel on one hand that we have an obligation to report this war, that it's horrific, and that there's on both sides massive human rights violations being committed, but that we're being, as time goes by, I mean, I was last there 5 weeks ago, and I'm gearing up for another trip, and I'm thinking, you know, now it's just absolutely horrific right now in August, and probably will be in September. So how do we get news out of Syria? How do we keep reporting this incredibly important story? That's where I am right now.
Well, Janine, in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places, fixers who cooperated with Western journalists have been targeted. Is that happening in Syria?
Yes, I think that they're frightened. I know that the people I worked with, some of them got threats. Some of them it was just threats from neighbors who knew that they were working with Westerners or working with journalists. And remember, in these kind of countries like Syria that have been under dictatorships for so very long, there's such intense paranoia. And the main thing is that, and this is what I believe some of these kidnappers who are taking these guys for no declared motive, it's because they think they're spies, or this endless paranoia that you're a Western spy, you're a Western spy.
Well, what do you do to remain unnoticed by the potential kidnappers?
You know, I just think I would like to say that I have good instincts, but I don't even think it comes down to that anymore. I just think I was lucky. I think now it's come to the point where I am overly cautious because I am older and because I have covered so many wars and I have seen so many of my colleagues killed or imprisoned. And, you know, this is not a risk I want to take. I feel that we really have to just be overly cautious now. And yet, at the same time, again, how important it is to do it.
Well, you were here about 2 years ago to talk about your most recent book, which was a very frank account of how hard your work is and the toll it takes on your family and life. So what compels you to keep doing it?
You know, my closest friends say this to me all the time. I think that for the same reason it compels people who are working for Amnesty or Human Rights Watch or photographers that want to document I think that during wartime is when the human rights violations happen. And yet most of the time if you're trying to establish something for a war crimes tribunal, or the evidence is gathered afterwards. And yet, it's during the war, it's while the conflict is raging, that it needs to be covered. And I think some of us, I probably lost this, I don't know if it's enthusiasm, but maybe my naive belief that if we were there as journalists, the worst thing wouldn't happen. And I think I probably lost that during the Bosnian War, reporting Srebrenica, the massacre of 8,000 men and boys in Bosnia. I think there was a belief, certainly amongst my colleagues and I, that if we were there to see it, if we were there watching it, if we were there to witness it, we might be able to prevent something. And another incident of that is East Timor. When journalists refused to leave the UN compound, where there were hundreds of civilians inside, and just trying to say, if we stay here, if we don't leave, if we write about what's happening on a daily basis, if we've got our satellite phones, then maybe we can prevent some massive massacre or abuse from happening. And it is true that in some way journalists did, and still do, have power in that way, because our job is to tell the story. Our job is to, you know, as it's often said, the heart of the matter is to bear witness to what is happening. And I'm just I'm terribly worried now about how to report Syria properly, and it does need to be continued to be reported.
Well, last summer in a piece you wrote for the New York Times, you said that it was hard not to see another Bosnia looming. Is that what's happening now?
Well, there's no template for any war, and I think that every war is different. But I certainly see a lot of Bosnia here, except that Bosnia, while it was horrifically dangerous to cover, you could go in and out freely. You could, if you could walk into Srebrenica, if you had the guts to do it, you could do it. You could walk into Foča, you could walk up to Serb paramilitaries and say, what are you guys doing? There was never, now that I think about it, the access meant much more of a physical thing. You had to do a lot of climbing and walking and riding donkeys and things like that. And the same in Chechnya, hiking over mountains to get inside closed countries. But once inside, your biggest danger was getting either shelled, sniped, or a minefield.
But go ahead. I was just thinking about
you
Bosnia.
You weren't getting kidnapped.
I was thinking about Bosnia in another way. Initially, we would hear that people thought of themselves as Bosnians, and then as the conflict developed, then suddenly they became members of various religious groups. And wasn't there a sense of a Syrian nationality before this whole thing happened, now broken down to Sunni and Shia and Alawite and Christian?
I think so. I mean, I think this is the whole crux of it, is that before, and, you know, when I tend to try to hang out with people and see what their lives are like and to try to enter into their worlds, and very similar to the Yugoslavians, who never, you know, really, a lot of my Bosnian friends resent it being called Muslims or Bosniaks or Serbs. I mean, they would say, some of them, I don't know what they were. To this day, I don't know what they are. You know, whether they were a quarter Croat, half Serb. They would just say, I'm a former Yugoslavian. And they really resent it being put into these ethnic boundaries, which now they're very much mirrored in. But in Syria, it was similar. I mean, there were distinct neighborhoods in Damascus or areas or regions, and there was very much a distinct feeling of what people were. But I can remember having conversations with people just saying, you know, what we don't want is to end up being like another Bosnia, that we're going to be put into cantons, and we'll be completely, there'll just be an Alawi region, and there will just be a Christian region. And I think that the whole dream of a place like that was this kind of multicultural ethnicity, which is completely breaking down.
My guest is Janine DeGiovanni. Her article in the latest issue of Vanity Fair is called Syria's Unspoken Crimes. We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about those unspoken crimes, mostly rape on both sides of the conflict. We're back with Janine DiGiovanni, whose latest article for Vanity Fair, where she's a contributing editor, is Syria's Unspoken Crimes. What is life like, everyday life like in Syria? Are banks and schools open? Are buses and trains running? Are people going to work and getting paid?
No, not really. It depends where you are, of course. I mean, what part, whether you're on the rebel side or if you're still on the government side, where, you know, people are... One thing I want to point out, too, when we're talking about how dangerous it is for us journalists to report it, I want to point out that, okay, it is for us, but think of what it's like to be a Syrian there. The figures for them being killed, being abused, being kidnapped, too, are astronomical. So it's often, I almost feel guilty when I talk about, you know, how dangerous it is for us to work there, because we get to come home. If we're so lucky, but they don't. And this is the reason why I started working on this story about rape inside Syria. I got a grant from the Nation Institute to begin researching torture on both sides. And the main theme that came out of all of my research, which took more than a year, was fear. The fear that average people felt, that they were completely unprotected. That if you were arrested, and I'm talking about both sides now, if you were arrested, if you were detained, if you were at a checkpoint and you were a woman, there was I don't want to exaggerate this, because often when people report rape, they do exaggerate it, and it's really important to report rape in a very methodical fashion, otherwise it gets over exaggerated. But the fact that this is happening on the ground it shows you how unprotected civilians are. And basically, when you said to me, what's it like to live there? Well, if something terrible happens to you, you have no one to go to. You don't go to the police and say, my daughter's missing. She was picked up at a checkpoint. I have no idea where she is. She was last seen at the central prison in Latakia, or she was last seen at a certain checkpoint in Aleppo, and I have no idea where she is. The women I interviewed who had been raped were very... to work on rape in the Muslim world is an incredibly sensitive issue, because women who have been raped, and I've been doing this as far back as the war, as Bosnia and then Kosovo and other Muslim countries... If a woman has been raped or touched, as they say it, the chances are they're not going to get a husband. And it may seem absolutely archaic to us in America, but this is what the reality is.
As we saw in Bahrain, where a woman reported that she'd been raped, and she was arrested, not the man she was accusing. She was arrested for having engaged in adulterous sex.
Absolutely. So these women first go through with the abuse, and then the aftermath. If they do get out, you know, why did this happen to me? Who do I go to? They can't tell their families. There's no such thing as a rape crisis center. And I do want to point out again, you know, sexual violence in Syria. It's not systematic like it was in Rwanda, meaning that. It's not trying to wipe out a gene pool, but it is definitely being used as a tool of war, as a weapon of fear.
As it has been since the beginning of humankind.
Sadly, yes. I mean, what would send an entire community running than to know that there were these barbarians heading their way to their village and they were going to rape their women? Then you would empty out a town, and that is part of the strategy as well, is that a lot of these small towns, before the paramilitaries would arrive, there would be rumors that they were coming, the Shabia, who are these kind of shadowy paramilitaries. And, of course, the people would flee. So that's one way of enforcing ethnic cleansing. It's one way of getting entire villages to empty out. And then, of course, you've got empty pockets of land. So this is all about fear. And getting back to your initial question, what is everyday life like there? If I had to use one word, I'd say it's fear. It's fear of you're going to lose your home, you're going to lose your family, that the door is going to, in the middle of the night, someone's going to come drag you off, and they do. Fear that you might say the wrong thing to someone, fear that you'll be turned in, fear that you'll be sitting in your house and shot, fear that the hospital where your son is being treated is going to be bombed and blown away, fear of the bombardment, the constant bombardment, of economic, of not being able to feed your family, of not being able to send them to school. Even for the wealthy people in Damascus, there was this, there, all right, again, we're talking about privileged people. It's not the same as people in refugee camps that are really suffering. But their whole lives have been completely disassembled. One day, you're sending your kid to a French school, you're meeting your friends for dinner parties, and then the next day, your whole life, you're sitting inside your house just waiting for a war to end. And it's now entering its third year. So I think that's the thing about war as well, is there's this kind of sense. You begin to live inside this very isolated bubble, and you have no conception of the outside world and what they know about you and what's happening to you. And of course, in Syria, because the internet's so closely monitored, people they have ways of getting around it. But it's a very paranoid society on both sides.
Is the sexual violence being perpetrated by both government soldiers and their loyalists and by the rebels?
Yes. I mean, although for me it was much harder to gather information about the rebels committing the crimes, even though I know and I've heard, you know, people did tell me about it, because it's just very hard to document it. I met one incredibly brave lawyer, and I don't want to say where he or she was, because they just were so brave, I couldn't believe they're doing, who was living in a rebel area, and they were, documenting crimes that the rebels were doing, even though he was living inside this certain city. And something like that would get you killed. And because the rebels, as we call them, are so fractured now, it's not what it was at the beginning of when it was an uprising. And it was basically people against Assad. It's now completely fractured into different groups, into fundamentalists, into radicals, and remember, with that, there comes a lot of infighting and a lot of jockeying for power, jockeying for position, jockeying for money.
And Assad has said there are a lot of outside agitators, people who aren't Syrians, who are now causing trouble.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's very easy to get, you know, to start your own brigade or your own battalion, your own unit. Let's make it a little smaller. You know, you get a few of your cousins, a few of your guys from the village, you put it together, you get a video camera, you document a few abuses, and then you try to send it to whatever country, whatever representative, to get some money, to get some weapons, and then you've got your own little unit there, and that's how more and more of them are springing up. So it's a very confused war as well. Not that any war is not confused, but in a sense, I think again one of the reasons that this is such a difficult conflict to cover, and more reason why we must keep reporting it, is that it's very confused. We're seeing a complete breakdown of society. And I think that, for me anyway, that's the part of it that I want to cover. I mean, I'm less interested in where the guns are coming from or what weapons are being used at what checkpoints. I'm really, you know, what's tragic for me is seeing this civilian population, which was and is extraordinary, this extraordinary blend and mix of people, and being completely ripped apart. And I would like to say, I mean, that how people say to me, well, what, you know, how is it going to end? I haven't, all I can see is a Bosnia-type scenario, that it will go on till it reaches its kind of climax of bloodletting, and then eventually there'll be international players that will step in. And I mean, Lakhdar Brahimi has tried continuously and failed, not by his own accord. I mean, I think he's been given an incredibly impossible job. But the fact is, you know, there aren't going to be peacekeepers sent in there, not for a long, long time. So until that does happen, if it ever happens, there's going to be a lot more people killed, a lot more women raped, men and women, I should point out. When I did this report, it wasn't just women that were being raped, it's men. And again, that's even more taboo than the women. So I think that it's very frustrating as a reporter, as a witness, to see this going on, and know that in a sense it's going to continue. It's going to continue, and that nothing can really protect it or stop it from happening until there is a broker at the end that does end this war.
My guest is Janine DeGiovanni. Her latest article for Vanity Fair, where she is a contributing editor, is Syria's Unspoken Crimes. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do people in Syria tell you that they're hoping that outside intervention will resolve the conflict?
Oh, absolutely. People in Syria, I mean, like people everywhere, the first thing they say is, where is the UN? And, I mean, that's a very, I know their frustration at that, and it's a very simple thing to say. I mean, every conflict I've ever covered, people, you know, when you find yourself in a refugee camp and it's absolutely miserable and the conditions are appalling, people are angry. And so what you have to do is you sit on the ground and you listen to them, and they have to vent and they have to get their anger out, and then they cry and they inevitably will say, you know, where is the UN? And I think there is this kind of misconception that I myself have always held, that, you know, the UN kind of swoops in and protects people. But I saw them working in Damascus last year before they had to leave. And there is still a small office there now. But, you know, there is not a peacekeeping force like there was in Bosnia at the end or in other conflicts. And there's, you know, often they're very limited. Their mandate limits them so that they can't actually protect a village, or they can't intervene in the middle of a firefight, even though they should, morally. But that's not what their job is, and it's not what their mandate is. And I'm afraid with Syria, when it comes to America, we're very burned out by Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think domestically there's problems, and people just look at Syria and they don't understand it, and they confuse it with Lebanon, which they remember from the Civil War in the 80s being this horrific mishmash of ethnicity, and who are the Sunnis and who are the Shias and who are the Falangists, and it's happening all over again, and what can we possibly do? And the important thing, though, is that Syria is such a linchpin for the stability of the region.
Well, I would assume that they thought when the first protests occurred that it would follow the pattern of other Arab Spring countries, Tunisia and Egypt, and eventually there'd be a relatively nonviolent change in Damascus, and that hasn't happened. But you said that there's also been a fracturing in the opposition. So do we have any sense of any unified goals now?
I don't see that, and that's what really worries me. I mean, I think initially there was this common goal of trying to overthrow Assad and following the tradition, following what happened in Tunisia and Libya to some extent and Egypt to some extent, and then moving forward into which they knew would be a kind of uncomfortable birthing process of democracy, but eventually moving out of a dictatorship. And that didn't happen. And over the ensuing months of war, and as people become more war-hardened, they become desperate. So Syria's also become a kind of brief, I mean, this has been written about a lot, and I myself, I haven't seen foreigners there, but, you know, there's other reporters that have seen foreign fighters there, and there's reports constantly, and I don't know how exaggerated they are, that it is becoming a massive breeding ground for various jihadist groups. But that would happen anywhere. That happened in Chechnya. When there's a vacuum, when there's any kind of political vacuum and there's a lawlessness, of course you're going to have it. It's Somalia as well. It's the same thing. It's a place where you can breed fundamentalism and radicalism. So I think the common goal of overthrowing Assad still is foremost. But I think it's, in a way, been, it's quickly being there's other factors that are coming into it, and I'm afraid a lot of that is money. Money and proxy war and who's supporting who and power. I mean, power is very important in this part of the world.
That's why Hezbollah has gotten into the fray.
Yes, they have. And I mean, and they partially, you know, they're defending their own peace, their territory, their you know, Lebanon, their part of the world that they want to protect. But also, they in a sense, they could not have gotten involved. Everyone else is involved. Everyone else is trying to stake their claim. And in the middle of all this are the civilians. So in a sense, do you think they care whether Saudi is backing who or Qatar is backing who or Hezbollah? That it doesn't come down to that. It comes down to whether they're able to evacuate a kid from Hama. I mean, I'm talking about someone I spent a bit of time with who'd been exposed to a bomb and had third-degree burns and couldn't get out of a refugee camp and desperately needed surgery. So his parents, what they care about is, take my son, get him out of here. You know, make sure he's going to be scarred for the rest of his life. He needs plastic surgery. He can't speak. His mouth no longer exists. It's not the political process that's interesting to them. It's when is this war going to end, and how is it going to end, and what's the aftermath going to be like? And also, how do you live again? How do you reconstruct a country after it's been ripped apart at its seams? How do you trust your neighbors again? How do you...
We're seeing that in Egypt right now.
Yeah.
Well, Janine, yeah. I'm sorry we've run out of time. Are you going back when?
Well, I'd rather not say.
Okay. Well, you're going back soon.
And
please be careful, okay?
I will. Thank you very much.
Janine DiGiovanni, her latest article is Syria's Unspoken Crimes. It's in the current issue of Vanity Fair, where she is a contributing editor. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.